Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to show number 123 from Engage for Success. I'm Jo Moffitt, and I'm your host for this afternoon's show. I've been away on holiday for most of July, so I'm just playing catch-up at the moment. But I'm very delighted to welcome this afternoon's guest, Jamie Lawrence. And Jamie is editor of HRZone.com, which I'm sure he'll tell us a little bit more about in a moment. First of all, before we get into that, Jamie, what about you personally? Can you give us a little bit of an introduction to you and whether your background has always been in journalism or HR or indeed a bit of both?
Sure. Thanks very much, Jo, and thanks very much, everyone, for having me today. I'm really excited. So I have always been in journalism and writing, really. I've always been a writer, and straight after university, I took a job as a copywriter, worked my way up to associate editor, so moved really from the conceptual, you know, writing for client side to the online journalism for a small business site. Made the jump to HR Zone and across country as well, from Ipswich to Bristol, and ever since working for HR Zone, pretty much trying to be the best online destination for HR professionals looking to work out what the workplace is going to be like in a couple of years, in all the things that HR has to do and prepare accordingly. We want to be the online destination where HR people can find what they need, whatever that may be.
Right. Right, and HRZone.com, is it predominantly? I mean, you're based in the UK, but is it predominantly a UK audience, or does it have a global reach?
So it is UK and has been historically UK, but we are really tackling issues that are global, for example, talent and engagement, obviously. But we are trying to cover issues from a more local perspective as well. So, you know, if you compare, for example, the engagement movement in the UK and the US, they're so different. You're looking at completely different things. They're very hard to compare because over there it's come from a different place and it hasn't evolved in the same way. So although these issues are crucial across the globe, they're very different as well. And really, to be an HR site that covers everything, you have to tackle these issues from the context and the country and the perspective in which they're based. And actually, if you're a global HR director as well, you have to consider these points from other countries' perspectives as well. So that's really the sweet spot, I think.
Right. Okay, interesting. Okay, so this afternoon's topic is going to be, we're going to be talking about which comes first, the individual or the team. And now that's quite an intriguing title, I think, isn't it, Jamie? It's a bit sort of chicken and egg, really, and one of those things that we could probably, you know, chew the cud on for hours and hours. But it's the kind of thing that you like to get your teeth into at the site, isn't it? But tell me, what do you actually mean by it? What are we actually talking about in terms of what comes first, the individual or the team?
Sure. So the point I'm really trying to make is that it takes very different things to engage and motivate individuals than it does to motivate teams or divisions, the kind of collective element of the workforce. And I guess in the workplace nowadays, we want people to work very well on their own and as individuals, but we also, and this has been crucially driven by the engagement movement, want them to work very well with others. Collaboration is a word we see often. But then the problem really comes because there are, I guess, perverse incentives created when we push out initiatives that we don't really think about. And I've got a couple of examples which I'll just run through. The first one is we use commission to incentivize and motivate individuals. And the problem with that is it creates a very siloed mentality where you really want to be seen as a star performer because star performers get paid well. And quite a few companies, and Dan Pink actually advocates for this, to move to profit sharing, where your stake in future returns are tied up with other people's stake. And that really incentivizes people towards a more collaborative mindset and towards more collaborative working practices. And this next example is probably more focused on engagement and its cultural alignment. And one of the things we've been, you know, pushing people to do is really define their culture and then hire people to so they feel a part of it. And we do this to build unified cultures where everyone's on the same page, which can be a good thing, but we'll talk about this later, but it depends what your kind of values are and what your culture is. But if you go the wrong way, you really breed out the difference of opinion and the diversity, which ultimately leads to conflict, which is a crucial part of continuous improvement and optimal decision making and the things that really lead to high performing organizations. And so cultural alignment can be a problem because you tend to get sort of groupthink and you don't get conflict, which is really
there's a little bit of the sort of law of unintended consequences going on here, I think, perhaps, yeah?
Exactly. It's all about what you aim to do, what you actually do, and what you don't realize those things are going to create in the workplace.
Right.
And it's really about having people on the ground and learning from them, you know, actually listening to what it makes people think and what it makes employees do.
So whilst one's initial thought would be, oh yes, it's all good to be team and collective, that can have unintended consequences on people who are more motivated to perform as individuals. You focus on people as individuals, and then you can end up damaging the team set unity. So it's about trying to balance the two, I guess, then, isn't it?
Precisely.
Yeah. So what comes first, chicken or the egg, individual or the team? Is this a debate that has always been going on, or have workforces evolved in recent years to make this something that has become more pressing?
So I think it's a perpetual issue in terms of what you said, the law of unintended consequences, but I don't think there's been the lens on it really because, you know, the workplace has been so financially driven in the past that we haven't really considered the effect on people and how that changes what they do in the workplace. And this kind of move to people-focused organizations is really shining a light on, you know, what happens when we do specific things in the workplace. How do people react? How do they behave? And also the focus on alignment and understanding, you know, how do we achieve our goals really on the ground? And that the two-way feedback thing, I think, as well helps, because to understand this issue, you really have to see it happen, you know. And then just two points as well. The workplace is becoming more diverse in terms of the multi-generational nature of it, globalization. And that means you have, you know, more values, different values, more things that people are driven by, more desires, viewpoints, these types of things. And so if you're coming up with values in the workplace, you have, you know, four or five, those four or five have to encompass a much wider range of viewpoints and sort of please everyone and make people feel welcome there. And that's very hard.
And then the second point is
that we're moving towards a more contingent workforce where people are going to be working in more geographically dispersed, you know, areas. And physical location, I think, with the sort of push behind flexible working, which is a great thing, people do forget that physical proximity is a glue that sort of helps people work together as teams. So this issue, I think, will become more important when we need to engage teams and have them performing well when they could be on different continents.
So in other words, the tension between is it individual or is it team or are we trying to balance both, that tension has possibly always been there, but organisations haven't really taken an awful lot of notice of it until relatively recent times, but also the nature of the workplace and the fact that people might be working remotely, working from home, means that actually it's becoming more apparent.
Absolutely. It's becoming more apparent, but I think also, you know, people now are seen more as a competitive advantage, and organizations are looking at ways to organize their people and get the most from them. Sort of, you know, I saw one phrase, unleash the sort of potential in your people. And to do that, you really have to look at how they work and, you know, what actually makes high performance. And this is why we focused on research so much now and how it's applicable in the workplace. So I think it's a kind of looking inward, people-focused future as well that's really sort of making this tension stand out more. And from a commercial perspective, making companies look to exploit it.
Right. And what about the sort of the famous Gen Y are going to be 50% of the workforce by 2020? Do they have, from your research, a bias towards one or the other? Are they more individualistic or more team, or is that not really coming out too much?
So it's a tough one because I don't like to generalize, but I think that maybe there's more of a tendency towards a kind of growth mindset in terms of the importance of collaboration, but also the importance of, you know, personal achievement. So I think it is both, but I don't think we should say that. It's kind of like saying Gen Y are all technologically savvy, digital natives. To an extent, it's true, but I don't think it's entirely true. And I think the danger when we put people into brackets is we create values and we create environments for Generation Y. And again, you know, treating I think people in the workplace as one homogenous mass can create the problem we're actually talking about.
Yes, interesting. It's interesting you should say that actually, because it sparks some thoughts. We're just doing some work with Peugeot Citroen. I think I mentioned this to you when we spoke earlier today, and we've created an online platform for some of their sales teams. Now, if you were to take the stereotypical approach, the perceptions will be salespeople are individuals. They work on, as you were saying, commission. They're totally focused on what they are doing as an individual, and they don't really think of themselves as part of a team. And yet, the kind of behaviour we're seeing on this platform is entirely collaborative. People sharing ideas, giving each other help, giving each other suggestions. So you're seeing actually a what would not be considered the stereotypical demonstration of behaviours from that kind of cohort of people. So it's really, really interesting to see, actually. So I think you mentioned Daniel Pink earlier, and obviously his famous autonomy, mastery and purpose. So how does this individual versus team thing play out with his thoughts around autonomy, mastery and purpose, Jamie?
So it's interesting because I think if we take that this research is applicable to the individual, and it's basically, you know, what he's basically saying is intrinsic motivators work long term, and they're the only way really to motivate people in the long term. The tension that I'm talking about isn't really that individuals and teams have different motivators, although they can do. It's more about ensuring that the culture and the environment that you create works for both camps and isn't weighted towards the individual or the team, because you need both for success. So my sense is that autonomy, mastery and purpose is a very efficient model, and it probably isn't everything, but it's crucially scalable. So you could have mastery is a good one, because that as a purpose can unite teams of quite diverse individuals. Everyone wants to get better. I think, you know, if you've got someone in a team who doesn't want to improve, you've probably perhaps got a problem that you need to address by perhaps talking to them, you know. So I think that mastery is probably an overhanging sort of, you know, umbrella that you could use to understand what everyone in that team needs as an individual, and then perhaps use that to lead to roles or focuses that allow everyone to master things as an individual, but also the team to function very, very well. So I think it's interesting. And then one of the other things you need to think about is alignment. So, you know, you have autonomy as a person, and one of the things that Dan Pink is saying is that, you know, if you give people outcomes, you can then allow them to go out and achieve them in their own way, and that autonomy is a way to empower people. And so if you also give a team autonomy and individuals, and you reinforce that as part of your culture, that, you know, we don't tell people what to do. You also need to consider in your team that you probably have hierarchical structures in some regard, and that someone will have decision-making power. So it's very much about clarity as to where people's autonomy starts and ends, and then within the context of the team, where it starts and ends. So often with this tension, I think it is just about clarity and just making sure that you aren't creating this kind of battle between the two. By not being clear. But this framework works for that, I guess, because you can use autonomy as a way to approach it for both camps.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting. I mean, you're saying it needs to work for both, and but in some respects, I think people have got both of those tensions within themselves too, haven't they?
Yeah, completely. And I think this is the darker side of collaboration, and I think collaboration is a fantastic thing, and that's a headline. I just come up with a clickbaity headline, but I think that collaboration is a fantastic thing, but quite a lot of the time we focus on collaboration without thinking about what the outcomes are. And you will find, and I think I read a paper on this reasonably recently, around the amount that people give when it comes to helping others, and there's typically a sort of ceiling where they won't go any higher because they feel they have to reserve some things for themselves, and they won't share all knowledge, because as we continue as a workplace and as companies judge people on talent and how much they can bring, people feel the need to live up to those, you know, those kind of stereotypes of the sort of star performers. So there's a degree of hold back and engineering with collaboration, and of course that isn't good for the company and for teams. And just coming back to your example about the platform that you built, you know, how much you want people to give and give and give and give, and you want to reward people based on what they're giving and the outcomes that come from that. That's the way to incentivize people at the top level. So perhaps, as I said, move to profit sharing, and then you've got the platform and you've got the benefits, you've also got the incentives. And then if you align your vision and your sort of strategic narrative around, you know, we sort of make decisions via collaboration, and we encourage it and we reward people for it, you've kind of got the makings of the team aspect of it there.
Yeah, interesting. And who within an organization should be caring about this sort of stuff?
So I think this is a cultural issue, really, and it's the type of culture issue where behind the scenes, there's a hell of a lot of complexity that has to go on to create a simple front end for employees. And because of that, I think this sits at the highest levels of the organization. This is a leadership thing, really. And if you delve through the kind of literature, you'd find stats that, you know, are representative of what happens if teams aren't performing well, or if people hold things back. And I think if people are looking to build the business case for the business considering these things, that's really where you start. So I think HR is the ones to kind of reinforce this and drive it. But, you know, if you're coming up with vision or a strategic narrative, that really has to be lived at the top and lived down every day.
Yes. So are you able to share some examples of organizations who've managed to strike this balance, in your view, Jamie?
So I'll give a couple of examples based on sort of individual parts of engagement that sort of could either go either way, or they could, you know, straddle the two type of thing. And the first one I'll say is there's a manufacturing company called Geist. I don't know if they're still in existence, actually, but in the 1990s, they went through a value sort of, you know, proposition and came up with their values. One of them was similar to innovation, which a lot of companies have nowadays as one of their values. The problem I have with innovation as a value is that you're basically saying that the culture values innovation, and that those are the things, and that innovative practices and innovative decisions will be valued above other things. And if there are people in your company who don't feel innovative, or perhaps have been there for a long time, and they don't play that role, but they play a very important role as perhaps someone who, you know, is a realist or is the backbone of the company, that new value, that which has never been there, might suddenly start making them feel very uncomfortable, especially if that value is reinforced and people are rewarded mm-hmm. for innovative ideas. What message does that send to them? Coming back to Geest, their value was innovation-friendly, which sends the right message to the innovators who join the company and can live as themselves and be true to who they are, the disruptive thinkers, but it also is creates an environment where the people who aren't innovative still are seen to be valued. And then if you have that as a value, you can, the amount of messages that you can send out that springboard off a value like innovation friendly are far more extensive than that spring off innovative, which feels diverse. It's actually extremely restrictive for what you can do, in my view. And then one more example, the restaurant chain Las Iguanas. So one of their business goals is continuous improvement, and their L&D initiatives, which obviously core part of engagement, again are focused on the sort of team experience and creating alignment. So one of the things they do is train staff in being able to recognize the type of experience the diner is on, and then making sure everyone's on the same page. So you have the people who come in for a, you know, quick tapas meal, or the people who are on a romantic evening out. And so through creating that alignment, everyone becomes on the same page and everyone approaches the evening in the same way, and you get a consistent experience for the end user. Instead of each person sort of doing their bit and then perhaps getting annoyed because someone else can't see that they're having a romantic night. Or it's just the type of alignment between teams that I think works very well. But crucially in that, the people also get their own personal development as well. So I think that's something good that kind of straddles both.
Interesting. It's funny, you talk, just going back to your point about Geest and innovation friendly. I remember a couple of years ago I was talking to a major retailer who must remain nameless, but we were talking about values, and they were saying we don't want innovation, we do not want 10,000 employees at all of our stores coming up with new ways of doing things, that our whole business would fall to pieces. And actually, you know, there is a point to that, isn't there? That actually sometimes yes, innovation obviously is a great thing, but it's got to be in the right place and harnessed in the right direction. And there isn't always opportunities for lots of innovation. And the example you use is sometimes you need other people in the team, don't you, who can take someone's innovation and create an environment where that innovation will thrive. Because we did some work with the National Trust a while ago, which was, it wasn't just about getting people to be innovative, it was about saying, well, how do you then take an innovative idea and actually enable it to spark and grow and take root and become something bigger? And that sometimes takes a different skill, very often takes a different skill, doesn't it?
You're absolutely right, and you know that isn't often taking an idea to successful implementation isn't pretty, and it takes a lot of groundwork, and it requires, like you say, a very specific skill set. It's time consuming, but you need those people. Otherwise, you're just an idea generator, and people get very, very frustrated when too many ideas get generated and there's no follow up, and that's a way to kill trust and the psychological contract. So, you know, by doing things that people think are very good can be very damaging. So I just think that considering these are very, very, very important. And just coming back to your point about, you know, we don't want innovation, I think that's why it's so important that in the engagement movement we have a real diversity of case studies from companies who do it from an innovative perspective, and, you know, companies that are very restricted, perhaps they're highly unionized, or perhaps they work in an industry where some things like innovation and collaboration aren't so suitable, but they make engagement work very, very well. And that diversity of thought and opinion, I think, is really, really key to sort of driving not only progress in this area and, you know, in this tension we're talking about, but to encourage more organizations to progress with their own engagement initiatives that really grow from who they already are as a business, rather than sort of taking other examples and putting them on themselves.
Yeah, you mentioned the engagement movement, and you know, it's a fairly lively movement, certainly in the UK, isn't it at the moment. Do you think the engagement movement, as you would currently see it, has kind of grasped this need to align the individual and the team, or is its emphasis more on one than the other at the moment, in your view?
So I think it's grasped team engagement, and it's grasped individual engagement, and very well and clearly articulated to organisations the need for alignment from both with the organisation. But I think the tension and the kind of law of unintended consequences angle, and the real finesse of your messaging and the values and the ideas and the narratives and the focus that you put out there, and how that, and the sort of chain effect of what that creates, I think there needs to be more consideration about that, because I think that's absolutely crucial. And this really is in some regards a two-way conversation piece. And if you have that trust with employees, you know, you people do not want to say, for example, to the example that I was talking about earlier, that they are holding stuff back when it comes to collaboration. You'd have to have a really strong relationship with an employee for them to tell you that. But that two-way conversation can yield a lot. And I think one of the things that's really important for the engagement movement is people to feed back into it the challenges that they've experienced, particularly in this area. I think it would be really useful in how they've been overcome.
Okay. And how does this as far as the classic four enablers of Engage for Success, do you see that framework working with the need to balance the needs of individuals and teams?
Absolutely. So the framework obviously is backed by the research, and it works for organizations. The key point, I think, is that you have to delve into each one and really understand what you're asking your efforts in that sort of area to do. So, you know, if we take a look at values, for example, are your values inclusive or are they exclusive? So diversity versus innovation versus innovation friendly. Or here's an example. Quite a lot of companies come out and say that their new value is honesty, and I don't think this impresses a lot of employees who have been acting with honesty for quite a long time. And so it's just about understanding that coming out strongly and doing things really boldly are good, but it's the finesse of your messaging and the inclusivity angle that's important. Just coming on to line managers, so again, that's about the empowerment of, I think quite a lot of line managers are very good at engaging their team members as individuals because they understand them, but are they creating a culture of collaboration and help and shared goals and those types of things? So I think the framework stands, but it is about the subtlety and about understanding.
They need support to make it happen.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay. And great. So we started off this conversation talking about HRZone.com briefly. It's been great to have you on the show, Jamie. Thank you very much for joining us. Where can people, if this has sort of sparked some thoughts with them and they want to sort of have a bit of a debate with you about it, where can they carry on the debate on this topic or share some thoughts?
Sure. So we'll be posting the link to the recorded radio show on our Discuss forum, which is a place on HR Zone where people can raise issues, talk to other HR professionals, ask their advice about work, things like that. So we'll be posting a link to that. And if you have any thoughts or comments or want to join in the discussion, you can go there. It's hrzone.com/community-voice/discuss.
Okay.
And please do come on there and join us.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for sparking some thoughts, which I'm sure it has done. So it's interesting, actually, because our show next week is talking about flexible working, which I think in some respects is a logical extension of some of these issues, because it's something that may well appeal to individuals, but is it appropriate to help support the team? And it'll be interesting to hear what next week's contributor has to say about these things as well. So thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, Jamie. We'll look forward to seeing the debate run in the future months.
Great.
Thank you, then.
Thanks for having me, Jo.
Bye-bye.
Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.